Traveling the Vortex.
We've joined the Doctor as he travels the Vortex and arrive at episode 588. I'm Keith.
I'm Sean.
I'm Glenn.
How are you guys?
Pretty good. Three solid weeks of Doctor Who that we've got to catch up on. Apologies, listener. We've been quite busy. It's that time of year. Of course, Doctor Who had to come back in the busiest time of year. So we haven't been able to get together to do our reviews, but we're going to try and catch up this week. This week we're doing... they went out of my head again. This week we're doing Dot and Bubble, Rogue, and The Legend of Ruby Sunday. Well, let's start with Dot and Bubble.
A world of fine times seems happy and harmonious, but an awful terror is preying on the citizens. Can the Doctor and Ruby make them see the truth before it's too late?
Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, this was a pretty good episode.
I liked it quite a bit.
This was a heart-wrenching episode.
The ending, yeah. Specifically.
Yes, specifically the ending.
Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive considering, you know, I would consider the rest of the episode kind of bubbly and light and fairly fluffy.
Really?
And then, for the most part, I mean, there's... the exploration of the racism, but also social media and all of the other stuff. But the characters and everything just gives it this candy coating to it that if you want to look under the surface, you can see a lot of darker, deeper stuff. But at surface glance, it's there. But then it hits you and strips away that candy coating at the end and makes you confront it no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I can see where you're coming from. I sort of felt like, number one, I felt like it was pretty intense because despite the fact that this gal was treating the Doctor the way she was and being the way she was, this kind of stuck up brat, I really kind of, I felt for her because I thought it was pretty intense. You know, she had this, disability to put it lightly, I suppose, because of the world she lives in. But I thought it was pretty intense every time she had to, progress. I think it gets a little bit light when the one guy shows up and kind of the hero of the hour and is trying to get him out of there. So I think it gets a little light then. But then that takes a massive, turn at that point. And I guess you could argue, to your point, that's near the end as well, where it all kind of starts getting stripped away. So, yeah. but you know, her selfishness and sacrificing him, that was the first, punch in the gut. I didn't want anything to do with her. I thought, you're terrible. You're just a vile person. But then you're kind of in the back of your mind thinking, okay, well, it's self-preservation, so maybe I'll give her a little bit of a pass. And then what she does at the end, it's like, I don't even care about this person anymore. I kind of wish she'd have died way back at the beginning.
Yeah, I didn't like her through most of it. And then my dislike of her grew as soon as she killed off Ricky September.
I suppose that I think that candy coating you're talking about is probably the visuals. Because the visuals are very colorful, bright, and light. So yeah, I would agree with that. And I think maybe... I was forcing myself to look underneath the surface more because of that.
I did not. I kind of was just glossed over I was right there with candy floss and wrapped up in the story and went from thinking she was certainly entitled, but just kind of vapid and dumb, to realizing that, she's just a horrible person and entitled and vapid and dumb, to going, she's racist and vapid and dumb and probably still entitled. And what a horrible, horrible individual. And I'm kind of mad at this episode for making me feel these things. It was just heartbreaking at the end.
Yeah.
Just, you know, his impassioned plea, let me save you. And knowing that because they are entitled and vapid and dumb, that they're going to go recolonize this planet. That's going to last all of about an hour.
Yeah, right.
I mean, really, immediately.
That's just it. That's the real sadness of the thing is they refuse his help only to, you know, drive off to their death. So,
I mean, you couldn't walk across the room an hour ago.
Mm-hmm.
And your first hug was half an hour ago.
Right.
And yet you're going to go colonize a world. Yeah, good luck with that. And once again, I'm reminded that the Doctor is a much better person than I am.
Yeah, because
I wasn't all that upset.
Because regardless of all of that, he was still willing to save him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't all that upset to know that, you know, they're not going to make it.
Yeah.
And his reaction was just so powerful there, too, once they turned their back on him.
And I think that Ruby's reaction is a testament to her acting as well, because she very much has to let him, you know, just sort of do what he does and deal with it, how he's dealing with it. And she can't, you know, she's halfway between console him and just kind of let him, you know, express what he's, you know, feeling, his emotion at that point. And just watching her reacting to him was pretty impressive. She seemed so helpless. That was what I thought. She acted really well, being helpless in that situation, not being able to, you know, do anything for him in this situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially considering she gets to kind of carry and be almost the Doctor through a lot of it, since she wouldn't accept the Doctor's help and Ruby had to step in and fill that gap.
Right.
It was an interesting way to do another Dr. Light episode that didn't feel as Dr. Light.
Was this one intended to be Dr. Light? Because I didn't feel it was Dr. Light at all.
Yeah, he wasn't available for filming, just like 73 Yards. So they had to basically, what he did was in a day.
I see.
And they were able to structure it in that nice way that easy to film.
Yeah, well, this one, yeah, you're right. This one definitely didn't feel like a Dr. Light, even though it was.
I kind of noticed it early on, but then once in stepping back and seeing the whole picture of the episode, I can see, oh, well, it works both ways, because there's a structural story reason why he's not there as well, as opposed to just, oh, he's on holiday.
Well, you want to move along to Rogue?
What did you guys think of the man traps?
What are the man traps?
The slug creatures that were...
Is that what they were called? I missed that.
That's what they called them in like the behind the scenes and stuff.
Yeah, big rubber monsters.
I thought they were fairly clever designed creatures. I mean, they look like giant slugs, but
I mean,
they were a bit different.
They were effective as a danger, I suppose.
Well, I like the fact that they were a means to an end. They weren't actually the bad guys for the episode. It was the fact that Dot turned against everybody, as I can't blame it. I did not really see that coming as to who was behind it. I thought that was a nice twist to it as well. Mm-hmm. And the revelation of, oh, they're just going through it alphabetically.
Yeah, and I think because it's... at first I had a problem with that, because I thought, well, that's kind of weird. Why would these slugs really even care? But knowing that it was Dot that was behind everything, ultimately it sort of makes sense that a AI would do something like that.
Mm-hmm. So just another reason not to trust AI. Got it.
AI and social media.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk about Rogue.
The Doctor and Ruby land in 1813, where guests at the Duchess's party are being murdered, and a mysterious bounty hunter called Rogue is about to change the Doctor's life forever.
Oh, this one was awesome.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, go ahead.
I really liked this one. I liked the fact that the Doctor and Ruby are just fanning out over the whole Bridgerton thing, only to discover that other people are doing it too. Mm-hmm. Oh, and they happen to be aliens and they're predators and they're, oh, okay, cool. I mean, it opens with a very Doctor Who thing, you know, it's a historical thing. And then there's a lightning bolt and zap and a pile of skeletal bones. Okay, you had me at hello. This is a Doctor Who episode. Let's go with this. But as it went on, and Jonathan Groff, who I love Jonathan Groff. I think he's fantastic. And he just played Rogue with this pitch perfect balance of slight menace and interesting fun. Reminded me a lot of River Song, and I'm not surprised that, you know, a romance was inspired and carried through on this, because it just, I, you know, the Doctor apparently has a type, you know. I didn't feel anything was forced, which I have seen many people comment online that, oh, they just did it for this. I don't think I think it felt very very natural and organic to the episode. I thought Ruby, just once again, cementing herself in the upper echelon of companions, because she handled herself so very well being without the Doctor for a good chunk of it. To the fact where she kind of outsmarted him.
Yeah.
And when we got to that point, I kind of kept waiting for the shoe to drop, because the Doctor's just like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. It's like, well, obviously it's not, because if Ruby had been taken over by this thing and turned into a dusty skeleton off camera, that would really kind of suck for all of us. So I don't think that's what's going to happen here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then Rogue sacrifice there at the end, and come find me, and you mentioned Ruby kind of feeling helpless and not knowing what to do for the Doctor in the previous episode.
Same here, yeah.
And the same here, to the point where it's just, come here and give him a hug.
Right.
Because sometimes that's what you can do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I loved it. I loved everything about it.
I was pretty much meh on it for the most part. I thought the trappings of it were kind of, oh well. Where it shines is the Doctor and Rogue. Anytime that they were together, anytime that they were developing those characters, that was great. I loved the performances of both of those guys. I loved the story between them. I loved the romance. I loved all of that. But everything around it seemed very weak to me. I thought the Bridgerton thing was a bit cliche. I mean, just that's what's popular now. So it was just one of those things. The cleverness of, oh, they're, you know, fanning over it, and of course, so
is this, referencing the fact that it's Bridgerton,
right? And they're fanning over it, and like you said, so somebody else is too. I absolutely thought the villains were uninspired. I don't know why we had to have bird people. They could have been anything.
Now we get to the point. Yeah. Of Glenn's complaint.
Well, I mean, they were just,
here's the crux of the argument. Well, and they were, it's very, an anthropomorphized bird.
They were very two dimensional too. There wasn't much to them. I mean, they're just, they take over bodies for this want of drama. It was just, okay. So that was kind of lame too. But and then my other problem with it was the end. I didn't seem like if he could push her out of it, it seemed like the sacrifice was a little bit not empty. I'm glad that he went through with that. I loved that he was going to do that for her and for the doctor. And then him saying, "Find me," I thought was cool, but the mechanics of it didn't seem to work because it didn't seem she was stuck in there, but he could push her out. But why couldn't he just push her out and him, you know, keep the momentum going and get him out? It didn't really.
The point was, it kept six people were locked into it.
And it had to be six.
He had to take her place, and it had to remain six people.
So why?
Because that's how it was programmed.
Yeah, but why can he push her out and take her place if they're locked down? That didn't make any sense. Why? It's like if he would have been able to explain it that he was able to take the lock off first before he did, or just there was something missing there that just didn't seem like a spatial displacement would fix it. That just didn't seem to make any sense to me.
I kind of look, you know, it's a bounty hunter tool that usually only holds one in and of itself. Well, that seems rather limiting if you're a bounty hunter, mm-hmm. you know, so yeah, I didn't care.
I kind of like the setting of it, the Bridgerton aspect of it, even though they kept referencing it. It felt like this is popular, so let's set it in this era. But I was okay with it because it's not like Doctor Who is shied away from
period
pieces in the past. Yeah. So
or even doing meta commentary on you know recent events.
Yeah. Recent media. That part I was okay with and kind of enjoyed. The villains I thought were, while one dimensional, entertaining at the very minimum. Rogue, I kept going back and forth on. I like the idea of the character, but I felt like he was almost too much of an opposite from the Doctor. He felt like he was so dour most of the time that it didn't seem like when the Doctor was having fun, like Rogue was having fun. It almost didn't feel like there was enough of a match for me. But
opposites attract.
It's true. I mean, opposites do. So, and I think that's what they were kind of going for, and not having, you know, this Doctor and Captain Jack Harkness being a couple, that would just be probably too much. And it felt like they were trying to do kind of the opposite Captain Jack. Jonathan Groff is such a charming guy and an actor that I would like to have seen a little bit more of that charm come through as opposed to being so somber the whole time and so serious. I don't know. I bought the relationship though, so that's why I'm torn about it. And Ruby throughout it was absolutely great, from telling off the one guy and the Duchess really being intrigued by that even before she was taken over by the bird person, to, you know, her friendship with the young lady who ends up being a bird person and being able to defend herself, and the callback to the earrings giving combat was was a nice explanation of how she could do some of that too. Right. So it almost felt like Ruby was combat a little mode. Underused. Yeah, combat mode. They spent so much time on the Doctor and Rogue that it felt like Ruby was a little underused, but what she was used for, I thought, was used well.
Yeah, see, I think that's why I didn't care so much about the Ruby role in this. I thought she did fine, but I really kind of felt like she was
backburnered.
Yeah, she was backburnered for this, which is okay. I mean, they needed to focus on that relationship, but nothing really stood out to me other than the coolness of the combat mode and how she came in and had the neck twitch like they do. She was really digging in deep into that character.
The fact that she was able to pick up on that and see that characteristic, that was nice. Speaks to her character of her travels with the doctors that she's paying attention to those fine details.
Yeah. So can we talk about the huge Easter egg?
What Easter egg is that, Glenn?
That I don't have to write a Schalke Doctor story anymore, because I think that I think this one fixed it, because I don't think the Schalke Doctor is an alternate Ninth Doctor. I think the Schalke Doctor is prior to Hartnell. I think Schalke Doctor is one of those mysterious
the
doctors
timeless child.
We don't know about. Yeah. And I think that works really well.
It's he's either a
or he's a future incarnation,
or it works in with the bi generation that there are two Ninth Doctors.
Well, yeah, the bi generation thing, I think that's a bit cheaty. I think it worked for what it needed to do, but I still don't buy, even though Russell's said it, RTD said it, I think I don't buy this whole fact that that by generation went down the line in any way. I just don't think that works. But you also don't care for the Timeless Child storyline, so.
I don't care for it. I don't enjoy it, and I don't particularly like it, because I feel like it's one thing to change the history of the show and do something different. I think it's another thing to change the character of the Doctor. And that's what the Timeless Child story does. Whereas before, the Doctor saw his people doing things and rebelled against it and left. This is, he's always been other. And I he's always been different. He's always been, super baby. He's always been, this alien entity that came down and graced our universe with his presence. And it's Christ-like. And I feel like that fundamentally changes the character too much. I am happy, believe it or not, that Russell has not completely retconned it, even though I kind of like him to. But I understand there's a measure of, respect and acknowledgement of the showrunner that came before. And the fact that he's leaned into it and tried to work around it, this, fundamentally terrible idea, but he's still trying to make it work within the framework of the show. I applaud him for that.
Yeah.
But
I
don't like it.
I think he's embracing it. I don't think he looks at it as a fundamental problem. I think he likes it. Although RTD's always been one of those kind of types to take chances, and he's taking a lot of chances with this season. And that's, and I think that he admired Chibnall for doing that, kind of restructuring things in order so that the story can go further.
I can admire him for taking the swing, because it's a big swing,
mm-hmm.
but I don't like it.
But here's why I think the Schalke Doctor is important. This is why it's important, because the Schalke Doctor was supposed to be the de facto Ninth Doctor. We all know that when they decided to carry the Doctor on in a web series, and then the plan was kind of squashed by RTD when he convinced the BBC to bring back the show to TV. So to me, this is RTD not only recognizing but legitimizing the work that was done by the cast and crew of that webisode, and together at the same time putting what was once overlooked by a lot of fans squarely in the continuity of canon. And I think that's what makes this inclusion very, very important.
Yeah, I just don't know that I can certainly set it before Hartnell, but that doesn't explain the Master's role in it, that he's a robot version. Not that they technically explained why he was a robot version of the Master anyway.
Well, I think they did, but not in that particular story. Didn't they do it in that vampiric story, that short story that came out in Doctor Who magazine? I think that explored it a little bit more, or at least gave a little bit more of a dropped line on the background of that. I can't remember for sure. It's been so long. That was way back in the day we reviewed that.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I thought we were
go back and look it up.
Yeah. I thought we were still working under the assumption that it was because he was digested by the TARDIS in the movie that he then came back as a robot.
No, it seems but. It seems to me like it had something to do because Gallifrey was wiped out, and that then the Shulker Doctor was on his own. And I was under the impression, at least from what the story said, was that the Master died in the ensuing battle or whatever it was for Gallifrey, and that the Doctor brought back his consciousness by injected it into the TARDIS and then creating the android version. Is the way I remember it. Again, I'm very vague on it because I haven't revisited that for so long, but that seemed to be the way it had happened. Anyway.
Gotcha.
I was happy. I was super happy because, you know, I like all my canon to work. So, and I think for me, this makes it work in my head canon.
And it was so, yeah, just woo, you know.
So well front and center. It wasn't like it was one of the last ones that you could barely see.
Yeah, right. That's and it's actually Richard E. Grant. It's not, you know, that's what was really cool about it. So, well, let's move on to the other one that dropped a really big, it wasn't an Easter egg, but it was a really big revelation, The Legend of Ruby Sunday.
The Doctor and UNIT investigate Ruby's past, but as the time window reveals horrifying secrets from Christmas Eve, the mysterious Triad technology unleash the greatest evil of all.
Go ahead, Sean.
Bum, bum, bum!
Yeah, I have nothing. Wow. I have nothing but great things to say about this episode. It blew me away, and it kept me on the edge of my seat from the beginning. The fact that we go down this road of using this this old technology that UNIT has held on to, that when they get down there and it's got all the old flips and switches and stuff, and the Doctor just laughs about it. The fact that he's, you know, knows that they have this time window and, you know, he's leave this technology behind. You're not to mess with it. And she's she says, you were, you know, you told us not to do anything with it. And he's like, where is it?
Which floor?
Right. That was brilliant.
Get some of that Nitro 9 you're not carrying.
And I like this whole, we're leaning into this. Okay, we're going to discover the mystery woman that's in this, you know, and we're going to go back to that point in time. And I like the fact that they explain the reason why the Doctor can't go back there, because he was there once before and he can't cross his own timeline. We've had that, you know, before, but I think it was nice that they acknowledged it again and put it out there for those people that are always going to say, well, why don't you just go back? So there's, you know, that, and they're leaning into this whole, we figured out a way in order to find out who this woman is. And just backing up to the beginning when he's, you know, first thing he comes out and he's like, I keep seeing this woman, and he's acknowledging the fact that, you know, he's seen the same person, the same face. And we, you know, we got to figure that out. And, you know, and they're like all looking at each other like, oh, well, and then they turn on the feed. And of course it's her. Immediately they're one step ahead of him. And then when
they've already figured out the anagram,
that's
everything.
The thing that I love the best is that the Doctor, being the smartest guy in the room, so he thinks, is explaining that the S triad is an anagram for the TARDIS, and Kate's like, well, thank you for that, Doctor. We'd figured that out.
It was nice to see UNIT get a win.
Yes, I loved that. It was so good. But, you know, again, leading into that, and then the the craziness.
Leading into the exploration of it potentially being Susan.
Right. Oh, yeah, and that's another thing that I think that has been this sort of red herring this whole time. That's the other thing that, you know, and I'll probably talk to this a little bit more when we get to the big revelation as well, but I really went into this series, especially when we did this by generation, and we kind of split off from the series and we renumbered the series number, you know, episode one, season one, episode one. And I kind of thought, oh, is this Russell T. Davis trying to take this in a direction that kind of soft reboots the whole thing?
But he's really been leaning heavily into the lore of Doctor Who, and I really absolutely love that.
Yeah, it makes me wonder why they bothered trying to do the renumbering.
Well, I think that was a Disney thing. I think Disney, it must be. I think really Disney solely be. Wanted that, but they had no idea what his intentions were. So I think
or
he just,
the connections he was going to make.
Exactly. And so I just think he thought, well, yeah, we can absolutely, if that's a requirement for the money, yeah, we can renumber them.
I absolutely loved all the Time Window stuff. I thought that was such a clever idea, and a way to work around the not being able to cross your own time stream. Of course, as I was watching it, as he was explaining that, I also thought to myself, well, okay, why don't you just pop in 5 minutes after you leave down the block where she was headed and confront her that way?
Yeah, there you go. That's true.
I mean, it's kind of the Angels Take Manhattan situation. You just can't think about it too hard. He can't do it. He says that he can't, so he can't. That's the final word on it. So the time window is such a clever way to try to work around that.
Well,
it was a brilliant concept.
They sort of try to hand wave that away with they've done this before, and they did this with Angels, and I think they've done it with other things, but wherever he's been, no matter how much time, it becomes time locked behind him, which, okay, that's a great explanation, except for when it's not a problem and you do go back into that same time. You know, it just doesn't always work because it's not consistent.
Well, this is obviously, you know,
it's obviously a very important situation that makes itself time locked.
Right.
It's always possible. Until we don't want it to be.
Right. Until it can't be.
Right. What I enjoyed the ride of this thoroughly and really look forward to seeing how it all ties together and connects at the end, because it still seems very disparate. Why was Sutek using this woman, and how was he using her, and why was he using her as a trap to bring the doctor here, and what does it have to do with Ruby's mother or whoever left Ruby at that church? I need more answers and more tying of things together before I can truly come to a conclusion of how I feel about the story in general.
Yeah.
But the ride on it was absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, so let's touch a little bit on this, because we were discussing it among my family, and we had originally kind of got the impression that that Sutek had latched on. We're going there. Sutek had latched on to the TARDIS at that time that it was manifesting in the time window when we saw that happen. And we kind of thought maybe that was when, but then that didn't really make a lot of sense, because then, you know, why was this happening? Also, they had mentioned that the TARDIS kept making this familiar groan that was consistent through the series. And it happened in Rogue. And he said it was, you know, indigestion. It happened in The Devil's Cord when they came out onto on the street, Abbey Road. It did it. But it also did it once in Wild Blue Yonder. And so then we got to talking about it, and I think maybe what it did is because the doctor makes the statement, the 14th doctor makes the statement later of, you know, I'm afraid of what I've let in with the salt. And so I think that that's where Sutek, you know, latches into the TARDIS at that point. And I think that's when Sutek gets on board.
I think, yeah, I agree. I think it's been hitching a ride the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to know why it took this moment to manifest.
So I think
why is it taking so long to manifest? Yeah. And why have we come across Susan Triad throughout time? You know, there's still a lot of unanswered questions just by saying, look, here's Sutek. Right. It doesn't explain anything. It's a great, oh, wow, they brought Sutek back. That's amazing. That's awesome. But you haven't answered any of my questions.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. And I think they need to address that specifically in the next episode.
Unimportant.
I mean, well, sort of, yes, because I mean, Susan is a, she's a vessel. I mean, Sutekh needed a vessel in Pyramids of Mars as well. So he mm-hmm. utilized, you know, bodies in that in order to, make his presence clear on Earth, because he's trapped underneath this, you know, pyramid, that Horus had trapped him in on Mars. So she's obviously a vessel, but yeah, I don't think there was enough of a explanation for why he keeps seeing her through time, except for the fact that it may have just been a projection, because Sutekh's been there obviously everywhere that he's been as well. So,
right. Well, and we don't know, even if Sutekh, as we believe, hitched a ride on the TARDIS in Wild Blue Yonder at that moment, we don't know what Sutekh hitching a ride on the TARDIS would have affected, or how it would have affected. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a reverse engineered cause and effect, or effect and cause, where it's not until we get to that moment where the Doctor has landed in this time frame and, oh, here's this woman, and Sutekh grabs her, but then it echoes backwards along the TARDIS's flight path.
Well,
I mean, any number of things is possible with the way, okay, we're going to bring him back. Okay. You kind of have to just, if you're going to go down the rabbit hole of, well, how does this work? I mean, yes, don't get me wrong, I want an explanation just like you guys do. But I think you're going to wind up with a timey-wimey kind of, and that's how it happened.
Oh, and that's okay. I just want them to try to at least give us some nugget to explain it in some way.
I'm the same way. As long as I just get little glimmer of why.
Yeah, and it's been too big of a plot point and too big of a mystery for them, I feel like, not to just go, it doesn't matter, Sutekh's back.
Right.
You've laid this groundwork way back from Wild Blue Yonder. You've got to, because that's the first time we saw her.
Yep.
We've got to at least have some sort of payoff there.
Right.
And the other, I assume that this was kind of a universal across the board. After I picked my jaw up off the floor, after I resigned myself the fact that we weren't getting Susan, I immediately went and grabbed Pyramids of Mars.
Yes, I've started rewatching it as well.
Largely because I had to explain to everybody, this is the guy. And Mel was like, oh yeah, I remember him. Yeah, this is the...
So... I thought what was crazy was when it was Harriet Harbinger. I should have seen that coming.
Another Harbinger.
Yeah. Yep. When she starts announcing the arrival, and the anagram is doing the thing. And even before they got to the Sue and Tech, it clicked for me just moments before. And I jumped to the edge of my seat and I said, oh my God, it's Sutekh. And everybody's looking at me like, what? And then of course it does the little Sutekh thing. And I was like, oh wow, they went there. That's incredible. And I was the same way. My jaw was on the floor.
Talk about an M. Night Shyamalan twist.
So
you could not have remotely seen this one coming.
So Keith, you're watching, Pyramids.
I'm halfway through.
Have you seen that, for lack of a better word, that time gate that in the sarcophagus that has the colors and the Doctor, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Do you guys remember the very beginning of the season, one of the very first posters we had of the Doctor, the 15th Doctor, and it's that swirly colors in the background?
Oh, it is.
You think that's been a hint all along?
Wow, that's...
Russell's been playing the long game.
Yeah.
It may be coincidence, but I mean, that's just really hard to overlook.
It does look like it. You're right.
Oh, and so...
he's reaching out, you see the almost hieroglyphs on his fingernails, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's his tattoos, but
Oh, I didn't know he actually.
Yeah, I think he has tattoos on his fingers. I think I noticed that once before. Some name drops, you know, the Mara, the Trickster.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. The whole pantheon of Discord is just laid out there. Some of them that we may not know. However, the three, and I can't remember how she said them, but there's three that she says together. Threefold
deity of malice, mischief, and misery.
That's got to be the gods of Ragnarok, right?
That's what I thought, yeah. too.
Okay, that's the first thing I went to was, okay, that's the gods of Ragnarok. Because you wouldn't have done them in threes that way if you weren't trying to imply that that was the case.
Yeah. So, the official podcast guys talked about this as well. Do you think Sutekh is the ultimate he who waits? Or do we still have one more coming?
I think this is it. And the reason I say that is because they frame it in the sense that Horus is the father of the pantheon, so that everybody else is below him. That means it's him, the god of death, and then below him are all of the ones that she names off. And so I don't know that there could be a higher than that. It would blow me away if it was. I think I had seen online somebody speculating that Omega but Omega is in a different, while Omega has almost omnipotent godlike powers, he isn't necessarily a god in the same way that the Eternals or the or the Pantheon are. And so I don't think it's going to be an Omega revelation. I really just think that the next episode will focus on how we're going to get out of this rather than try to surprise us with somebody even bigger. So no, I don't think there is a bigger.
When I had the thought too of I wonder if it's bigger, but at the same time I wondered if it wasn't going to be a next season bigger.
Mm. Well, that not could be, I suppose.
Episode two bigger.
Yeah.
A next season bigger that they were, you know, also behind Sutekh's return to bring themselves back.
Maybe. I don't know.
It depends on how much they resolve in the next episode.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm there yet because I think that this is, I think everything has been leading up to that moment in Legend of Ruby Sunday. The other thing that we don't know about is Mrs. Flood. I mean, she was being very, suspicious there when she was watching Cherry Sunday. And so
she obviously knew something was happening.
Right. She knew he was coming. She said, you know. But I also think that I think that also is a red herring. She broke the fourth wall in the first 15th Doctor story. She, you know, told or she says, "What, have you never seen a TARDIS?" I mean, so there's something about here, but I think it's going to be a switcheroo. I don't think that she's necessarily in league. I think that they're going to turn it around, and she's actually going to be a good guy. I think she's going to be part of the Ruby solution. Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen it, you know, said that maybe she is Ruby's mom. I don't know if that's going to be the case, but if she is powerful, then that would mean that's a reason why Ruby exhibits these, you know, very lightweight powers that she has that haven't been explained yet, but like making it snow, I guess is really her power.
Yeah.
There's a bit of weight, I think, given to the idea that this is the Sutekh is the one who waits. When you go back and watch Pyramids of Mars and they talk about the length of time that he's been imprisoned in the Eye of Horus, waiting to get free. And then once he escapes and gets into the time tunnel, the Doctor's solution is to move the event horizon essentially forward so that he never reaches the end of it.
Right.
So he's still waiting to get free.
That's true.
it was so good to go back and watch that episode again anyway.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I enjoyed it so much.
Now, you said that, you know, this immediately gives you the idea that, okay, I know which Tales of the TARDIS is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But
they've confirmed that now.
Oh, they have confirmed it.
Yeah.
They have officially confirmed it.
Right.
Dropping tomorrow, 6:20, they will...
UK time.
...will be... The Doctor and Ruby in Tales of the TARDIS with Pyramids of Mars.
Yep.
And so it's basically the Doctor explaining Ruby.
Yeah, it's the Doctor and Ruby that will be bookending it.
Okay. So he's gonna tell her this is what happened.
I suppose. Yeah, that's how they'll catch it. And you know, I remembered this back when they announced this. I remembered a promotion or a production still of them in the memory TARDIS. And I remember at some one point, somebody bringing up, well, why are they in the memory TARDIS? And then people said, well, it's probably just, it's a production photo. So it's, you know, probably just publicity shot and not necessarily tied into anything, but clearly it is tied in.
It is. Unfortunately, it did somehow leak, or there was somehow speculation, because the article I saw before they officially announced the Tales of the TARDIS of what it was going to be, the article I had read speculated that it would be Pyramids of Mars.
Hmm.
So when it wound up being Sutek, I wasn't as
surprised. Oh, you mean prior to Legend of Ruby
Prior
Sunday.
To.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That article I shared with you guys, thankfully you guys didn't read the whole thing.
No, I didn't. No, yeah.
It's really cute that you think I read things you send me.
I do sometimes. What happens is if you send it and I'm not busy, I click on it and read it. But if you send it and then I'll just like read the headlines and then I'll like move on because I'm busy and then I'll forget to come back to it. So.
Well, and had my message sent like I had intended, you wouldn't have needed to, because you would have gotten the essence of what
I
was trying to say without spoiling it, potentially spoiling anything.
Right.
This episode was so good.
All right, well, let's wrap it up there, and we'll probably revisit a lot of this next week when we do what's coming up next on the schedule, which is Empire of
Death.
you're asking, you do
the schedule, so.
More Doctor Who. I don't know the title of the next one.
Empire of Death.
Thank you. Next time, we'll be talking Empire of Death. And probably a recap of what has come before.
Right, yeah. All right, well, you can find us on our website, travelingthevortex.com. And if you get any value out of this podcast, consider putting some value back into it. Do that by clicking on the Patreon link there. Also, consider giving us a 5-star review wherever you subscribe to this podcast. Anything else before we close this one? If not, until next time, I'm Glenn.
I'm Sean.
I'm Keith.
Cheers.
Good night, everybody.
Be seeing you.
You have been listening to Traveling the Vortex. Doctor Who and all of its associated programs are owned and trademarked by the BBC. No infringement is intended or implied.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who podcast network.